Welcome to the Semi-Interesting Podcast, where we explore some of the unique legal issues in the global semiconductor industry. My name is Nathaniel Lusek. I'm an IP attorney at the law firm of Hodgson Russ and one of your hosts.
My name is Elizabeth Morris. I'm an IP attorney and the director of intellectual property and products at Pure Storage in Santa Clara, California, and I am one of your hosts.
Depending who you ask, non-practicing entities or patent trolls are either the biggest scourge of the entire patent system or are just using patents exactly as they were intended. Regardless of your opinion about the business model, the effect of these entities spans industries. Their friendly offers to license affect all kinds of products. The semiconductor industry is certainly not immune. But why are they so prevalent? How do they build up their patent portfolio? And more importantly, what do you do if you receive a letter from them? To answer these questions, we're joined on this episode by my friend Pat Muffo.
Thank you, Nathaniel and Elizabeth, for having me. Appreciate you guys having me here. It's going to be a lot of fun. My name is Pat Muffo. I'm a shareholder at Polzinelli. Shareholder is our version of partner. I do all things IP from litigation, including non-practicing entity litigation on the defense side. I do patent prosecution, licensing agreements. I'm sort of an outside chief IP counsel for a lot of my clients where I take any of their IP-related issues and either take care of them myself or find the correct person to do so here at the firm. So once again, thank you for having me, and that's who I am.
Pat, so nice to meet you. I've really been enjoying meeting Nathaniel's prior law school friends over the past couple episodes. So this topic is, I'm sure, interesting to lots of companies and entities out there. And I think one of the things that comes up all the time is, what do you define as a patent troll or as an NPE? As a person who has worked on these cases, you know, what's your explanation for a patent troll definition?
Yeah, so I think that's a great question and a very important one, because the term patent troll is itself pejorative. That's not a compliment, right? And so it's important to discuss what a patent troll is if we're going to use negative language to refer to something so that we're not being overbroad in the use of that term. And I think some people are overbroad in their use of that term. So here's my version of what a patent troll is. It is a patent holding company that files a large volume of nuisance lawsuits. And I'm choosing my words carefully when I say that. And here's what a patent troll is not: a company that just enforces patents but doesn't make any product. That is more often referred to as a non-practicing entity or a patent assertion entity, but that latter category could include universities or research organizations that are certainly inventing, but they're not in the business of making products. And so they are in the business of intellectual property. That latter term could also be legitimate non-practicing entities, which I certainly have no problem with. Companies who have found quality patents that they've done significant due diligence on, that they believe in good faith to be valid patents, and they are trying to enforce those patents against what they believe in good faith to be infringers. You know, a lot of those more legitimate non-practicing entities are at times funded by litigation funders who go through yet another round of diligence to make sure that the claims hold water. The more legitimate litigation funders have something like a 95 to 98% rejection rate in terms of rejecting potential patents that come their way in different opportunities. There are certainly more illegitimate litigation funders, so that's a whole other conversation. But there are a lot of companies that simply are in the business of making revenue off products. We're well familiar with them. And then there are other companies that want to make revenue off of IP. And just because you're in that latter category does not make you a patent troll.
Now that we've narrowed the definition, or at least screened out some of the other non-practicing entities, focusing in on the patent trolls themselves, how do they build up their portfolio? How do they find their targets? They're obviously in it for money, but what's the business model look like? How do they work?
Yeah, so in general, they file a large number of nuisance lawsuits, and they're hitting a lot more singles than they are home runs. And that's kind of the general idea. They're getting small numbers each time they file a lawsuit. Again, they have no appetite for pushing the case far in discovery and getting into actual litigation. Their dream is a quick settlement and then move on to the next victim. Oftentimes, these patent trolls will not even proceed to litigation. They'll just send a cease and desist letter and hope that they can extract a settlement without even filing a lawsuit. Of course, once they file a lawsuit, there's additional leverage and motivation. And so they know that, and they sometimes use that to their advantage. But it's very simple. It's a nuisance lawsuit, and you either file a nuisance lawsuit or send a cease and desist letter. You extract a small amount of money, then you wash, rinse, repeat, and you start all over again. In terms of where they find patents, they find them in different forms. They can find them through patent brokers, which are companies that are again, some are more legitimate than others, but they facilitate the transfer of patents between companies that want them. There are brokerage exchanges, which are, in essence, marketplaces that provide these patents and allow people to purchase them. And then bankruptcies is another place. Whenever there's a merger or some sort of an acquisition, oftentimes companies will then say, well, we're not going to use this particular part of the target company. And so we have all these patents. What do we do with them? Well, let's try to monetize them by selling them off. And divest them and make money that way. So that's another way that patent trolls can get patents and then enforce them against other parties. Now, the other parties, the defendants, how do they find their targets? And in some ways, the question is, what targets do they not go after? There are some companies that have made a name for themselves for refusing to settle with patent trolls. And I don't want to put their name out there. I'm not sure if we represent them in some form, but there are a lot of companies that have sort of gone out of their way to push back, and the trolls just don't go after them anymore. The converse of that is when you have a reputation for paying up and giving the patent troll that quick settlement that they're looking for. And in that case, that becomes a target. You develop a reputation by doing that. If a troll sends you a cease and desist letter and you pay within 2 months and just cave it right in, well, guess what's going to happen? Maybe not that exact same company, but another affiliated company is going to come after you a couple months later and sue you for something also ridiculous and extract another small settlement, and it's going to repeat itself. So, you know, they find their targets by knowing who to go after and who not to go after. A lot of that's reputational. A lot of that's kind of, you know, just picking and choosing and hoping they get lucky.
You mentioned a couple times the term nuisance lawsuit. I was wondering if you can give us a little bit more detail on what makes a lawsuit a nuisance lawsuit. And then maybe also connected with that, in going along with your definition of troll, you know, why are there such negative connotations around pen trolls?
Yeah. So when I say nuisance lawsuit, you know, that gets to why there's a negative view of patent trolls. They're sort of abusing the system. Patent litigation is very expensive. And if a troll were on this call, they would point at me and say, yeah, it's very expensive because your billable rate is too high. So that's the upfront part of this, with me being just honest about it. You know, the system in many ways, I think a lot of patent owners would argue the system is broken because you require litigation in order to enforce patents, and lawyers are not cheap. But the reality is patent litigation is expensive, and settling with a troll is often less expensive than pursuing patent litigation in any meaningful way. So if you're a company and you're sued by a patent troll, what do? You pay me millions of dollars, or do you pay the troll, you know, five figures to get out of it? That's the reality, where the trolls know this, and they know they can use that to their advantage. And if they file enough lawsuits, they can make a meaningful amount of money by sort of leveraging my billable rate against me. The reason why they're nuisance lawsuits as well is because I believe, and again, this may get to the idea of patent trolls filing lawsuits that don't really have a whole lot of merit. Some of their arguments are just ridiculous. And it gets funny almost. It would be funny if it wasn't so upsetting. You know, I've seen certain trolls assert patents that show a company's location on a map. So, of course, that we're all infringers if we ever, you know, go and try to locate something on a map. You know, there's a patent that a troll claimed covered a drop-down menu. So if you go to a drop-down menu, all of a sudden you're infringing this patent troll's patent.
I think I had that one at my previous company. I think we had that particular troll.
this is where we cross paths, Elizabeth, you know, because, you know, they don't stop with my client. They'll go to your client. And it just, it kind of rubs you the wrong way because you feel like there's no way you can look at this in good faith and believe that you own the patent on a drop-down menu. But that's what they argue. There was one where if you move a cursor over a product on some sort of e-commerce website and then it zooms in on the product, you know, there's a patent troll that claimed to own the patent for that. So it just gets a little bit ridiculous when you see these assertions and you just think to yourself, you know that patent doesn't cover it. You know that if this were pushed through the merits, pushed through an IPR or on the other side, pushed through trial on infringement, that you know you would lose. But you also know that it's cheaper for us to give in than it is to get to that point. And that's what makes it a nuisance lawsuit and abusive of the system.
Let's talk specifics. I mean, there's dozens, if not hundreds, of these entities out there. I know from your publications, you focus in on one in particular called IP Edge. Tell us a little bit more about them.
I've kind of picked on them a little bit just because they've been in the news quite a bit recently. IP Edge is a parent company of a bunch of smaller, you know, single entity LLC patent trolls. And IP Edge, as of a couple of years ago, was the most prolific patent troll in the country. And they filed a significant number of lawsuits. They filed more lawsuits than any other entity in the country. So they were the number one patent litigation filer in the country. And there's a judge in the District of Delaware, Judge Connolly, who requires all parties to disclose who is funding the case. And you know, the patent trolls think this is overreach. The defendants typically do not. I'm not going to provide my opinion as to what I think, but that's his order. And you want to be in his courtroom, you have to comply with that order. Well, IP Edge just didn't comply with the order one day. And Judge Connolly came after them pretty hard in order to require them to comply with his order. And as he did so, he found out that IP Edge had concocted a scheme to sort of shield them from liability should the litigation go south. What they would do is they would find random people who would own the patents and would own the individual troll LLCs. And then IP Edge would give them a small percentage of the licensing revenue in return for those random people taking on liability. So how random are these people? One was the owner of a fried chicken food truck that someone at IP Edge had apparently eaten at. And so this guy, this fried chicken, I imagine it's wonderful fried chicken for him to be given this role, but he was never involved in the case. He had no clue what was going on. He didn't know what the patents were about. He hadn't read the patents. The actual company, the fried chicken guy, was not calling the shots, but IP Edge was. And that goes against our ethical obligations as the lawyers, because the client itself, of course, has to make the call on settling or not settling a litigation and among many other things. And so, you know, last glance, IP Edge was sanctioned. I think there was a woman who was affiliated with IP Edge down in Texas who has been sanctioned something like $5,000 a day until she complies. So it's getting kind of bad and nasty. And, you know, the IP Edge just refuses, though, to provide the information that Judge Connolly wants and that the order requires, and instead has now appealed this to the federal circuit now a second time, and it's a complete mess. But it's the definition of patent trolling gone wrong, and as a result, surprise, surprise, fewer cases are now filed in the District of Delaware after this whole debacle happened. So, you know, whether or not his order was overreach or not, IP Edge sort of is the poster child of bad facts make bad law, and this is something where the facts of what they were doing were just so ridiculous that it caused the ripple effect that we're seeing now with filings in the District of Delaware.
So have we seen just a lot less filings in the District of Delaware specifically because IP Edge isn't doing it, or are other trolls also trying to get out of that district?
A lot of litigation funders who fund, you know, not troll litigation, but more legitimate litigation, you know, their money comes from international sources, and oftentimes they don't even know if they go completely up the chain where the money is at the end of the day, where it's coming from. You know, I don't want to get into specifics of that, but sometimes it's impossible to comply with this order as a result. And so for that reason, a lot of people have gone to East Texas or West Texas Judge Albright in West Texas has affirmatively stated that he will not require something similar to what's happened in Delaware. I don't know if Gilstrap or any of the other judges in East Texas have followed suit, but it doesn't seem like they would ever require that. So, you know, they kind of know that if they can get jurisdiction in East or West Texas, then they'll be fine. Other places to go are the home base of the company that they're suing, but there may be pluses or minuses for that. But as a result, a lot of the cases are now leaving Delaware and going to other jurisdictions. And I think this order is in large part because of, you know, causing that. But IP Edge will never file there ever again after this. It's just caused them nightmares over the past year.
I really like this fried chicken guy's story. I hadn't heard that before, so that's a good troll story to know. Getting back to you know, the theme of our podcast, which is specifically for semiconductor industry, do you have any stories or any interesting tidbits for things that the semiconductor industry should be worried about? Are there trolls that are really active in that space?
There's one that seems to pop up on the docket quite a bit, a company named Bell Semiconductor. They bought the patents from Bell Labs when they merged with, I believe, Nokia or Alcatel-Lucent or one of them. And those patents have been asserted many times. What I do want to be careful about is, you know, they bought a lot of patents. And so these patents are being asserted in different ways. They come in all different shapes and sizes. Some of the Bell Semiconductor cases have all the markings of a troll case, where either the lawyers or the short pendency of the case, you file and 3 months later it settles. That suggests a low settlement amount. The high volume of cases, that all indicates at times troll behavior, but there are other cases that Bell Semiconductor has filed that have gone a lot farther. Some have gone to the Federal Circuit. So to that end, you know, are they themselves what I would consider to be a patent troll? Sometimes, perhaps, but it seems like for them, it's on a case-by-case basis exactly what they're doing. But in terms of non-practicing entities generally, they seem to be one of the bigger ones, or at least one of the larger filers who are going after companies in the semiconductor industry and trying to get licensing revenue from them.
I'm thinking back to when I was in house, and it was somewhat easy to get rid of some of these because the name of my company had the word semiconductor in it, but we didn't actually make semiconductors. We made equipment to make semiconductors. So I'd get some of these letters and just sort of shrug and say, well, you guys didn't actually look up on our website what we do. So any pointers for what you should do if you do receive an offer to license? I mean, other than checking a docket or hopping on the internet in order to determine if this is a prevalent patent troll and how many times they might have filed an actual lawsuit?
I see it in one of two forms. You know, the branches of the tree start with, you get the complaint, and what do you do? What I would recommend to anybody in-house is to first check the docket and to see whether defendants often answer the complaint or otherwise respond to the complaint, either with a motion to dismiss or something else, to see whether they've hired a lawyer to represent them. The reason I say that, there's a company, I'm sure there are others, but there was a company last year, they've since popped up on the docket a couple other times, named Cedar Lane Technologies. They filed a lot of lawsuits. And it was interesting because you go on the docket and very few of them ever had somebody file an answer. Very few of the complaints were ever answered. And what happened is, you could tell the Cedar Lane filed a lawsuit, and then somebody in-house looked at the docket and said, well, nobody else is responding to these. So then they call up Cedar Lane and either told them to pound sand or, you know, gave them what I imagine was a very small amount of money, and then Cedar Lane just dismissed the lawsuit. So in that case, I'm certainly not giving legal advice to say you don't need a lawyer for everything, but in that case, I think you can get by without using a lawyer and without shooting yourself in the foot by doing so, with the caveats I just mentioned. In any other case where the defendant has answered a complaint or otherwise responded to a complaint, I think the answer is to hire a competent patent lawyer who knows what they're doing and can push back. It's going to save you money in the long run. I think trying to negotiate these things, the trolls know what they're doing. They'll kind of delay it down the road until they have you by the throat. And then all of a sudden, you're up against deadlines and having to worry about those kinds of things. And so, you know, pay a lawyer. I know it's not fun, but then once you have hired a lawyer to represent you, you can now then go down the road of negotiate a settlement and run the risk of being a target, or tell the troll to pound sand and run the risk of having the lawsuit proceed farther than you want. I think a good lawyer who's had experience in this area will know which trolls are more likely to push things once you tell them to pound sand. And so you can sort of weigh the risks there. But, you know, it's just for the ones where nobody represents them and for the cases where there's a defendant that never answers, those I think most in-house folks can take care of. Or for all else, just hire somebody who knows what they're doing and they can direct you down the right path.
So what about the technique of trying to get the patent invalidated, right? Sending it to the Patent Trial and Appeals Board, doing a PTAB action of some sort. Has that effective at getting you into the, you know, not target group of entities?
It certainly would, yeah. Because, I mean, IPRs are not cheap. And if an NPE or troll sees their patent go into an IPR, they're going to take notice of that. It's significantly more of a burden than they were expecting when they first sent you a cease and desist letter or filed a lawsuit. And then if their patent goes up in flames, then they're out of business. So it's a very effective method at getting out of the case. It's a more expensive way to do it. But if you believe that this is a patent that isn't valid, that's certainly one way to approach it.
You had one more question kind of related to that, which went back to your, was it Delaware? The place where trolls don't like to be anymore. Is there a way to try to ask for a jurisdiction change if you're, you know, if you're sued in Texas and you're hoping to get into a place that might be more favorable to the, you know, the defendants in these cases?
Yeah, you can certainly file a motion to transfer and try to get out of certain of these jurisdictions. The judges down there tend to be reluctant to grant them. Yeah, even Judge Albright has been very reluctant in West Texas to grant them, Gilstrap in East Texas. They get hit with a lot of these jurisdictional challenges to try to get out of there. I mean, just to give you a sense as to how companies look at some of these jurisdictions, in East Texas, I was there during December one time for a hearing, and it was December, so it was Christmas time, and everyone was in the Christmas spirit. So Samsung decided they were going to set up an ice skating rink directly next to the courthouse. And the ice skating rink had Samsung logos all over it. And we're looking at this, and it's in East Texas. It's in Marshall, Texas. And so it was December, but it's in Marshall, Texas. And then we realized that the purpose of this was to create goodwill of the people in that area. And so and this was actually on Last Night Tonight with John Oliver as well, where he talked about how, you know, for somebody who's out there in Seoul, South Korea, looking at a line item on an expense report that says keeping an ice skating rink frozen in Marshall, Texas. So that's sort of how they look at these jurisdictions, that a lot of the defendants in these cases see those jurisdictions as being favorable to plaintiffs. I think that's a more nuanced conversation that is not necessarily black and white, but a lot of people don't, as a defendant, don't like being in East or West Texas. They try to get out, and there are sort of varying degrees of success depending on the facts.
Well, Pat, I'm glad that we were able to end it on a high note, reflecting on the goodwill that can come out of some of these lawsuits and controversies. Thank you so much for joining us today and sharing your experience and wisdom regarding what to do if, not necessarily if, but when, as a large corporation, you receive one of these letters.
Yeah, thank you for having me, Nathaniel and Elizabeth, and congratulations on the podcast. I've been following from afar, and it's been a lot of fun and very interesting to hear some of the different stories you guys are telling here.
Thanks so much, Pat. I was really interested in this particular episode, so thanks for the fun stories about the Chicken Man and the ice skating rinks and you know, all the fun things that we learned from our patent trolls.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of the Semi-Interesting Podcast. You can find more episodes wherever you get your podcasts, including YouTube.
And if you enjoyed the episode, we always appreciate 5-star reviews. While we talked about legal issues, none of the information shared during this podcast is intended to be legal advice. If you have any questions about information we cover or ideas for a future episode, feel free to contact me or the other attorneys at Hodgson Russ. You can find contact information at www.hodgsonruss.com.